Okay. Hey everyone, welcome back to Black Clock Audio Tales. This is day 7 of Bronte. Feels good. And we've got Andrew Grace on the show, Dr. Andrew Grace, PhD. This time the D stands for depressed young ladies with the last name of Bronte, I think.
That checks out.
How's it going, Drew?
I believe that is what the D stands for.
Yeah.
Hello, I am Andrew Grace. I have a PhD in English from the University of Oregon, where I studied 19th century Gothic fiction, including all of the Brontes. Bronte.
But not that other Bronte, because he died of alcoholism or something, right?
Yes, there is a fourth Bronte, but he was a dude, so he does not count.
There were some other Brontes that I think were older Brontes that just didn't live to be old enough to have imaginations.
There were two older Brontes who did not live long enough to have imaginations. That is correct.
See,
with a high mortality rate.
I did that thing that you complain about where people don't just fucking look at Wikipedia.
That's right. If you'd like to know more about the Bronte siblings and what they died of, check Wikipedia.
And
if you would like sophisticated literary analysis, listen to me.
If you don't want either of those, listen to me. They died of grave water.
That checks out.
Yeah. So,
they
Drew.
They do not live in a healthy environment.
No.
Something that shows up in their literary works, whereby there's a direct correlation between unhealthy environments and children dying.
Wow, that's amazing. Too bad no one went into like the health field with that family, but you know.
To be fair, the health field in the middle of the 19th century was not something you went into to promote health.
That's true.
The health field in the middle of the 19th century was something you went into because you were a sadist.
I was going to say because you wanted to cut people open and, yeah.
Vivisection. Also because you wanted to prescribe yourself drugs.
Yeah. That checks out.
I mean, not that you really needed a prescription to get the drugs. It just sort of sounded better.
Sure.
The middle of the 19th century, I don't think, had a lot of strong, like, substance control laws.
No, not really. Not really. Nothing was very controlled at all. But we're not talking about drug laws of 19th century Great Britain. We're talking about Jane Eyre specifically.
That is correct. So Jane Eyre, the second novel by Charlotte Bronte, albeit the first novel published after her first novel, The Professor, got rejected about 7 times. Jane Eyre was published originally in late 1847. It had second and third editions in 1848. A relatively successful novel, followed by 2 more novels, Shirley and Villette, that are less popular, less well known. Shirley is nigh unreadable, and Villette is pretty fantastic, okay. Just in case anyone wants to know.
Good to know.
Jane Eyre was published under the pseudonym Currer Bell because there was a fear that the novel would not be successful if people knew it was by a woman. Mm-hmm. And of course, the name Currer is the most masculine sounding name anyone has ever devised.
And Bell is so manly.
Very manly ass name. But that went along with the novels published by her sisters when Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte was published.
Which we'll be covering later. Nope, sorry.
Oh, no, you're good. Alice Bell and Agnes Grey by Anne Bronte was published under the pseudonym Acton Bell because we all know someone is definitely named Acton.
Did they know any men that had names other than Bran or Branwell, and that's why they had to come up with these, like, well, what sounds like Branwell but isn't Branwell? Bell? Oh, that's a real name.
I think, you know, they knew men, but I think mostly from Germany.
Okay.
Where they had spent some time in school. So the the naming situation may have gotten a little skewed. I think they mostly took their names from, like, Blackwoods magazine. Uh-huh. They were like, definitely the names being used in the sensational fiction in Blackwoods magazine, those are the names we should have.
Okay.
I jest a little, you know, in case anyone who actually knows something about 19th century fiction is listening. I understand that I am not being fully accurate.
Okay. So let's get into this. Let's talk about the first 11 chapters of Jane Eyre.
Yeah, so let's give a little context on the kind of book Jane Eyre is, which actually, I should specify, it falls into a lot of different categories. So the first category that people tend to think of with Jane Eyre is that it is a female Bildungsroman. Where a Bildungsroman is the, you know, building of the man. A novel that shows us how a man grows up and receives his education and develops and becomes part of society. And Jane Eyre is a classic example of someone taking that model with a female protagonist. So we start with a very young Jane. We get her education. We get the trials of her early adult life. Through her marriage, when she sort of enters society in that capacity. In addition to being that kind of coming-of-age Bildungsroman sort of novel, it is also a mystery novel, one that draws on the Gothic literary tradition, which is, of course, where my interest in it primarily lays, since that's what I studied. And in addition to being a Gothic novel, it also falls into a kind of moralistic journey. It actively references Pilgrim's Progress, this very classic novel of morality tale, you know, where someone endures a certain set of hardships but succeeds because of their virtue. And so Jane Eyre definitely wraps all of these things up together. It also has a strong romance element that draws in some ways on something like the tradition established by Austen, where we have some lovers who are initially kind of combative, or they sort of challenge each other before they come around to realize that they're in love. So it's definitely a novel that draws on a lot of different literary traditions. And as people discuss it, as they analyze it, they oftentimes focus on one or the other. They oftentimes focus like, here is a novel about a young woman coming of age, or here is a novel that has a Gothic mystery, or here is a novel with this strong moral dimension. And as we go through the novel section by section, I kind of want to highlight how different sections really rely more on different traditions. And the early section of Jane Eyre, the first 11 chapters, where what we really learn about is Jane's young life, her life at Gateshead with the terrible Reeds, and then her life at Lowood, the school. That's much more in the Bildungsroman or coming of age genre, where we're kind of learning who is this person and how does she grow and develop before we get into the trials of her young adult life. And that stuff does not make for as good of a movie adaptation. Mm-hmm. So even though it's a good quarter of the novel, it's rarely more than like a solid 10 to 20 minutes of any like movie adaptation.
Also, dibs on the band name, The Terrible Reeds.
Ooh, yes. Terrible Reeds. Featuring John on guitar until he dies. Shortly. So, chapter one opens with this sort of bleak moment of the weather is bad and there's no opportunity of going for a walk. Mm-hmm. And it is really interesting to consider that the entire novel of Jane Eyre, all of the ridiculous things that will happen by the end of Jane Eyre, including a mansion being burned down, mm-hmm. all starts with the fact that it was raining and there was no possibility of going for a walk.
Sure.
Because that then becomes the impetus for the conflict between Jane and her adopted family, the Reeds. So, some context there. Jane is an orphan. Her parents are dead. Her father was a clergyman who caught illness while providing services to the poor. Because, again, that's what happens in the middle of the 19th century. And when he died, she was left with her mother's family. So she was left with her mother's brother, her uncle Reed. The Reeds are a wealthy family. But Uncle Reed also died. So by the time we get into the first, like, 10 pages of the book, what we know is, like, three people are already dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so now Jane is not with any of her biological relatives. Instead, she is left with her aunt by marriage and her aunt's three children. And her aunt's three children consist of the boy one, the pretty one, and the insincere religious one.
All right.
And right in chapter one, because it is raining, because they can't go for a walk, this is going to result in the boy one, John, bullying Jane, Jane fighting back, and Jane being punished. So we learn right away Jane is alone in this household where she is unloved and unwanted. And that sets the tone for one of the most significant things that Jane wants to accomplish throughout the novel, which is that she wants to be loved and she wants to love others. But by the end of chapter one, what we have is Jane being dragged to the Red Room, which is, like, such a magnificent, like, yes, our house just has the Red Room, where we put the disobedient girl, and we just lock her in there as punishment. Like, yeah, that's just a thing.
What, you don't have a Red Room?
I mean, not that I tell other people about. So, the Red Room is, of course, the room where her uncle Reed died. Mm-hmm. So that's key information we receive in chapter two, as Jane is terrified of being in the Red Room. And we get a very young girl perspective, I mean, young child, the gender here isn't so essential, perspective on being in the room where her uncle died. Because, of course, of all the Reeds, her uncle is the only one who actually liked her. And yet she's still afraid that this room is haunted by his spirit. And she's afraid that because her aunt has not kept her, she made to her uncle, her aunt has failed to love and care for Jane. So Jane's like, well, since my aunt didn't keep that promise, now my uncle is going to haunt the room. But the only person that's somehow bad for is Jane. Which is a little, you know, confusing, but in a way that sort of makes sense for a young child who's just afraid of this ghost. And so while she is trapped in this room, afraid of being haunted by her uncle's spirit, she passes out. And so, of course, chapter three begins with her suffering from an illness, because if you pass out under duress in the Red Room, you will, of course, suffer from some kind of illness.
Okay.
Well-known fact in 19th century medicine. And so in chapter three, we get a sense of Jane has some allies in this house. And her allies are, first of all, there's Bessie, the nursemaid. And Bessie's a mixed bag as an ally. She cares for Jane and she wants to help Jane, but she also wants Jane to just, like, act more the way other people want her to act. And she does some great victim blaming. There's a lot of, like, Jane, you really did bring this on yourself by trying to stand up for yourself. You know, if you would just stop telling people the truth, everything would go better for you. If you'd stop expecting to be treated like a person, you would be okay. Which kind of makes sense from someone in the working class in a wealthy household, right? Sure. But we're definitely going to get different foils for Jane throughout the novel, different ways where we see how other women in various economic strata try to survive in the patriarchal culture of the 19th century. And so they give us options like, how could Jane behave and what would the results be? And one of those early ones is Bessie, where Bessie is an example of someone who sort of just goes along with expectations. And even though she has a human heart, and even though she's not a cruel person, she's not going to stand up for herself, and she's not going to stand up for Jane. You know, she'll comfort Jane a little on the down low. She tells Jane stories. Although we do realize that part of the reason Jane was so afraid of being haunted by her uncle's spirit is that she hears all these ghost stories from Bessie. And I'm just going to, like, asterisk this here. Like, so we have young Jane who hears stories about, has this quasi-supernatural experience in the Red Room where she thinks maybe she has encountered her uncle's spirit, or maybe it was just like a lamp going across the lawn. And that kind of uncertainty, about whether or not supernatural things are occurring is going to be important throughout the novel. And especially in later scenes at Thornfield. So it gets established early that Jane, at least, is always fearful of supernatural things, and that may be related to the stories she was told as a child. The other kind of ally we get in chapter 3 is that Jane is introduced to the doctor who checks on her, and the doctor kind of tries to get a sense of, like, Jane being mistreated. And the doctor is actually the one who suggests to Mrs. Reed that they just send Jane away to school. Like, you hate Jane. Jane hates you. You know, why don't you just send her off to get an education? So, of course, Mrs. Reed goes out of her way to find the worst school she can.
Yes.
And that's what we get in the next chapter when we're introduced to Reverend Brocklehurst. And in that discussion of, you know, where do names come from? I haven't broken down the etymology of Brocklehurst, but it sounds so right for a severe and punishing, but also hypocritical, wealthy clergyman who doesn't feed the students at his school, you know, Brocklehurst.
Yeah, no, to me, I hear that name, and I imagine, like, Brian Cox playing this, like, big, heavy, like, Germanic English, like, clergyman. I'm not sure if you remember Brian Cox. Oh, man, he was, like, the headmaster in Rushmore, or the, yeah. Or, like, I was gonna say, like, the chief of police in, like, Super Troopers. I mean, he played Hannibal Lecter in the original, not white, not Red Dragon. Anyway, I'm gonna have to cut this part out. So,
but Brocklehurst is originally described, like, when Jane first sees him, he is described as a black pillar.
Yeah,
you know, like that's the name Brocklehurst, and that's the image of Brocklehurst. And the discussion between Jane and Reverend Brocklehurst is one of my favorites. In any novel, because he tries to tell her all these stories of what happens to sinful children And the subtext of what he means is what happens to girls who actually try to assert themselves or do anything they want to do. And so he quizzes her, and he quizzes her on, like, you know, do you know what hell is? And Jane's like, hell is a lake of fire. And he says, you know, and do you know who goes to hell? And she's like, oh, you know, sinners go to hell. And he's like, so what do you need to do to avoid going to that lake of fire? And she says, I must stay in good health and never die. And, like, it's such a killer moment for 8-year-old Jane, who's definitely 10. But that, you know, she's got this, on the one hand, clear moral view of the universe, but she knows that her view of the universe doesn't line up with the one that other people are trying to thrust upon her. That it doesn't line up with this more conventional, patriarchal Christianity that is all about threatening people with punishment in order to keep them in line. Mm-hmm. And instead of trying to weasel her way out of it, again, instead of trying to, like, accommodate that and just say what he wants to hear. Like, she's not willing to just say what he wants to hear, so instead she says, I must stay in good health and never die. Now, this also sets up one of the ways in which we're going to see Jane evolve over the course of the novel, because here, as a child, she's very much a materialist. Like, she has heard of spirituality, but as we see with Uncle Reed and the possibility of Uncle Reed's ghost, she's afraid of spirituality. So even if Uncle Reed would have been a benevolent ghost towards Jane, she's still so terrified of him that it makes her sick. And instead, when she thinks about spiritual concerns, her response is, I must stay in good health and never die. She gets materially what she must do, and as we'll see over the course of the novel, she does develop a more nuanced understanding of spirituality that will be part of her character development and her ability to kind of navigate life. So she ends to school, and she has some very, you know, young adult novel-esque problems where her aunt tells Reverend Brocklehurst that she's a liar, and then Reverend Brocklehurst tells everyone at the school that she's a liar and tries to punish her for breaking her, like, chalkboard. And so for, like, 2 chapters, we're in, like, Little Women for a little while.
Yeah.
But we also learn that, like, of course, if Reverend Brocklehurst accuses her of being a liar, all of the other children at the school just sympathize with her because they all know he's a jerk.
Yeah.
And in those early chapters, when she first goes to Lowood School, she also finds some new allies. So we get Miss Temple, who's the teacher at the school, who treats her with respect and helps her learn and gives her cake. And she meets Helen Burns. And Helen Burns is a little older, but just another girl at the school. She's kind of been sent there, we get the impression, because her mom died, and then her father remarried, and her father's new wife didn't really want her around, so they sent Helen off to the school. And Helen tries to live a very aesthetic life. And this becomes another kind of foil for Jane of, like, how can women respond to 19th century patriarchal culture? We get Helen's response, which is to sort of try to become nothing. Okay. Because, again, that's another direction that patriarchal culture pushes, is to say, well, like, if women don't want anything and if they deny themselves everything, then, you know, they kind of become invisible, and that's sort of one view of femininity. And of course, it's a view that ultimately kills Helen Burns. She just doesn't have Jane's will to survive. So Helen gets consumption and dies. Jane sneaks off to stay with her, and so Helen Burns, in fact, dies in Jane's arms. But before she dies, they do have some spiritual discussions that become the first bit of Jane moving just a little bit beyond materialism, is learning these ideas of Helen's. And Helen's ideas are really drawn from Swedenborg, a theologian admired by Emerson, who dismissed the idea that humans would ever be damned. And instead, Swedenborg thought that humans would kind of like evolve into angels. And so that becomes key to what will later be Jane's belief in the concept of universal salvation, where like no one ever is damned, everyone is saved. But for now, it's just this idea that Helen introduces to her, and Jane is too young and too kind of caught up in her present material circumstances to really embrace. Hmm. But it's there, right?
Yeah.
And Helen dies, and a bunch of girls suffer from typhoid because Lowood School is built on bad property. So... This is going to be a reoccurring theme in the novel, that the location of your building determines who gets sick.
So, and also the Bronte back, family.
Yeah, yeah. The Bronte family got sick a lot because of where their house was. So they caught on to that, and it is threaded throughout the novels.
Oh, yeah.
So then Jane, after Helen dies, we get a time jump. The school is reformed, Reverend Brocklehurst is sort of stripped of his authority, and a board of governors takes over. They decide that the girls should be fed, should have warm places to sleep. I mean, truly, truly generous reforms. And so Jane spends 6 years at the school as a student, and then she spends 2 years at the school teaching. And this hits another, like, important crux of the novel. It's easy to look at the novel as Jane is constantly miserable and suffering until she finally reaches something that will make her happy. But the novel actually gives us multiple places where Jane is in a position where she could live a decent, stable life. So, by the end of chapter 10, you know, Jane could be a teacher at Lowood School. She's successful. The children like her. She has lodgings. She has a salary. Like, she's got a decent life, better than what she had when she was, like, an orphan hated by the Reeds. Mm-hmm. And so, one of the key questions is always, when Jane has these moments of stability, why does she leave them? And so we get some reflection in chapters 9 and 10 of, you know, why Jane wants to find something different, why she wants to move on. And these are some of the reasons why the novel is oftentimes described as a proto-feminist novel. So the novel's written before the concept of feminism as we now think of it existed. It is not a feminist novel, and as we'll get to later, there are deeply troubling gender dynamics. Mm-hmm. But we do get reflections from Jane about wanting more than what is offered to her by society. So she's offered by society the option of, like, hey, you can be a teacher. You can hang out here. You can have lodgings. You can have a salary. Like, that's not a bad life for a woman. And Jane says, like, no, I want more. I want to see the world. I want to experience love. I want to love others. You know, I want more than this. And so she chooses to leave behind Lowood School, leave behind teaching, and seek a different position. One of the catalysts for this is that Miss Temple, her teacher ally, gets married and quits. And so here we get another sort of foil for what are the other options for women. So she could be like Miss Temple and, you know, be a teacher until she finds a husband and then quit her job. And it seems like that's not what Jane wants, right? She doesn't want that path. That very conventional, you know, what we would now think of as a kind of middle class 1950s path, except for it was 1848. Mm-hmm. And so Jane chooses to advertise and seek a new position, and she finds a position as governess at Thornfield Hall. And so this is where Jane leaves behind Lowood. And what we know about Jane at the point where she leaves behind Lowood is she is still kind of a materialist individual. She is still afraid of spiritual dimensions. She still feels lonely and isolated, but she no longer feels as vulnerable as she did at the Reed household. And we know that she wants more than what the world has given her. She wants to see and experience things. And that takes us into the next section of the novel. And so in chapter 11, Jane travels to Thornfield Hall and meets... Oh no. I've forgotten a name.
Well, then we'll just call it spoiler alert.
I cannot believe I've forgotten what is obviously the most important name anyone could ever need to remember, which is... Why do I not remember?
Rochester?
No, I'm not. I'm looking for the Fairfax, Mrs. Fairfax. Okay. There we go. Mrs. Fairfax, who is distantly related to Rochester. She's the housekeeper. And one of the big twists is that Jane thought Mrs. Fairfax was the owner of Thornfield Hall and didn't realize that there was a man who owns Thornfield Hall, a grumpy, masculine man who we will meet later. So we get introduced, our first introduction to Thornfield Hall is in the dark at night, and we're introduced to the idea that the Rochesters are a very old family, with an oftentimes violent history. And it's all a little vague and mysterious, but it's also tied up with that, you know, confusion about thinking Mrs. Fairfax was the owner when in fact she's just the housekeeper. And so we get the arrival at Thornfield, and immediately Jane is put in a position of questioning her decision. And so we get this new stage of her life set up, but it's set up with some uncertainty. Like, what has she gotten herself into? She thought she was going into one thing, like she was going to be the governess for the child of some old lady, Mrs. Fairfax. But in fact, she is the governess of the child of Mr. Rochester.
Okay.
And... Chapter 11 ends then with the introduction of Grace Poole, who exists mostly to remind us that Jane is the worst detective ever. Because Jane meets Grace Poole, supposedly surly seamstress, and is like, cool, I don't need to know more about what she's doing here, that's fine. And every time Jane encounters Grace Poole, supposedly surly seamstress, who sometimes goes off on a bender right before something terrible happens in the house, Jane is like, cool, I don't need to know what's going on here, that's fine. Definitely legit. But that's looking ahead a little to the rest of the incidents at Thornfield Hall. But by the time we get to Chapter 11, what we know is there are strange things at Thornfield Hall. You know, why is Mr. Rochester never there? What is Grace Poole doing? What is Mrs. Fairfax's role in all of this? And who are these Rochesters, this, like, ancient family? Mm-hmm. And that's where we shift from this novel of education and moral development to something more like a gothic romance mystery.
Yeah.
And that's what we get for the next dozen or so chapters.
All right. So maybe what someone should do is take Jane Eyre and split it up into three movies, The Hobbit style.
Oh, could we really drag it out? I mean,
let's have 2.5 hours of Jane Eyre's childhood.
we're gonna need to add a few incidents, right? You know, to really like flesh that out. So.
No. Musical montages. You can stretch stuff like out forever with just like 3-4 musical montages.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we could get a musical montage of like Bessie telling her ghost stories and then her like jumping every time something falls down in the hallway.
Yeah.
Musical montage of like Miss Temple like cutting tea cake and pouring tea and like reading from a book.
But here's also the problem is musical montages generally are used to speed the passing of time. So it's like, well, this week to that week.
Right. I mean, like, we could do, like, musical montage the 4 times we had tea cake. You know?
Yeah.
You could do it.
Musical montage. This is how terrible my childhood is.
Yes! Musical montage of, like, all her adopted siblings picking on her. That'd be a really sad musical montage.
Yeah. Well, Jane Eyre. It wouldn't be... If you made it into a musical, it wouldn't be cheery.
That's true. It is not a cheery book.
No. Not really. So, if people have liked the 11 chapters so far that they've listened to, read previously of Jane Eyre, what would you recommend they also check out, besides continuing to read Jane Eyre?
So, besides the rest of Jane Eyre, I mean, if you like the first 11 chapters of Jane Eyre, all about suffering orphans and terrible schools. I mean, I guess if you've never read Dickens, you could consider Dickens, but I cannot in good faith recommend Dickens.
Yes.
You know, the first 11 chapters of Jane Eyre, anyone who likes the first 11 chapters of Jane Eyre should read Elizabeth Gaskell. They should read Wives and Daughters. They should read Cranford, just because everybody should read Cranford. Cranford, though, is hilarious. The first 11 chapters of Jane Eyre are not necessarily hilarious. But in particular, Mary Barton by Elizabeth Gaskell also has a dynamic of like a young woman's education and coming of age, but it never gets into gothic mysteries the way Jane Eyre gets into gothic mysteries. Instead, it gets into like industrial labor politics and struggle. So the first 11 chapters of Jane Eyre are definitely the most grounded chapters of the novel. They're the least melodramatic. You know, they sort of describe her situation before we really get into the more heightened romantic tension of the later chapters. And Elizabeth Gaskell, who really promoted Charlotte Bronte's work, who was a big supporter of Jane Eyre, her novels are more grounded, they're more realistic, and unlike Dickens, they really portray characters as human, possessing a feeling worthy of sympathy. And I think also much more mindful of gender and of femininity than someone like Dickens.
Hmm.
So, Gaskell. You should definitely read Gaskell. Everyone should
read
Gaskell.
Nice. Drew, have you... I don't know if I ever loaned you a copy of this book or not, but did you ever check out Dolph Steinberger's Panorama of the 19th Century? It's a kind of a study and look at 19th century Germans and how they thought of themselves, especially in contrast to the British. They were like horrified that the British were doing vivisections on dogs and just like how terrible like British medicine was and compared to like continental Europe. And it was kind of like, isn't Germany amazing? France is pretty cool too. The British are horrible monster people who live on a dirty, wet island and need to stay there.
I never read that book. I have looked into the sort of differences in especially how science developed through the 19th century across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
In Middlemarch by George Eliot, one of the characters actually addresses exactly the idea you just mentioned, which is that Britain is way behind Germany. And the narrator points out that another character has devoted his entire life to a project that he would know was pointless if he ever spoke German or read German. That he's looking to a unified key to all mythologies, and the narrator's just like, and if he had ever bothered to read anything by the Germans, he would know that his project is dumb. Oh, Casaubon. Poor Casaubon. But yeah, the development of science as a subject for universities and the idea that you would conduct scientific experiments at a university and that one of the primary things a university could do is really promote science. We see that idea kind of travel from Germany very slowly over to Britain. So it's definitely not a thing in 1848 when Jane Eyre comes out, but as I've discussed before, it is kind of a thing as we get to like the 1890s when we have a resurgence of a much more supernatural science fiction kind of gothic, like Dracula, the Great God Pan, the Beetle.
Which we've covered those.
I know. So this is before that. This is the predecessor.
Very cool. Very cool.
Jane has all of this uncertainty about material versus supernatural, and she has no science to help her.
Yeah.
There, no expertise.
Yeah, that's really too bad.
Yeah. I mean, hence the terrible detective part.
Yeah, that's something else I want to be, like, I keep thinking about is, like, man, that would be a funny, terrible, I don't know what it would be, like, Jane Eyre detective.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like...
Jane Eyre, P.I.
At the end of the novel, very end of the novel, Jane is, like... 22 years old, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we could definitely have a sequel where she's a detective, you know. Ooh, but it could totally be like Jane Eyre, paranormal detective.
Da, 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 da.
We have successfully covered the first 11 chapters.
Sounds pretty good, Drew. Come back next week and talk about the other big chunk that we're going to go through.
I know, that will be the best chunk.
Okay.
So, just in case anyone's wondering, you know, why are we talking about young Jane's struggles with being an unloved orphan and then going to a terrible school? It's because next week, it'll be Jane and Rochester who are the best.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a terrible couple. They should definitely never get married, but they are the best.
All right.
In terms of interactions.
Okay. And of terrible couples that you and I have talked about on this show, whether it be Daisy and Tom, or I don't know, Dracula.
Dracula and Mina.
Yeah, I was gonna say Dracula and anyone, because you know.
Frankenstein and his creature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All kinds of toxic relationships. How's this rate in the toxic relationship?
You know, as I put it on that scale, I start to understand why people still think this story is romantic, right? Because it's better than those.
Yeah.
But as we will get into, I mean, like, before the concept of gaslighting existed, like, this is the most gaslit relationship.
Before the book Gas... the Gas... Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there are a lot of lies, a couple of threats, an enormous disparity of wealth and power and age, but still better than Dracula and Mina. I mean, so again, plus it does not involve Tom Buchanan, and essentially any relationship that involves Tom Buchanan is the word. So by the standards of the relationships we've discussed, possibly the best one, that really says a lot about the quality of the relationships we've discussed.
We should
like talk about an Austen novel sometime or something, you know, really get a relationship that's like only kind of problematic.
What I want to do is talk about comparisons, not right now, but sometime in the future. I want to talk about comparisons of Jane Austen to the Brontes.
Or
Charlotte versus Jane Austen.
they're right there. They are readily accessible comparisons. All about it.
Good. Well, Drew, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking Jane Eyre and Charlotte Bronte and Brontes in general with us and the Gothic tradition. As always, it's good to have you on the show, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. See ya.
All right. And if you wanted to... did you need to plug anything or shout anything out or anything like that right now?
No, I'm good.
Okay, cool. All right. We'll see you next time, Drew.
See ya.